Session number 24573, Reel 9.
Mr. Darcy, Reel 9. We got to the point where you were going out on your first patrol aboard HMS Gore with the first escort group, and you were training en route. This was February 1944. Right. If you'd like to continue, perhaps an account of what happened on that first patrol. And
yes. The weather was, for February, the weather was really quite good. All the way down the Irish Sea and into the top end of the Bay of Biscay, it was very reasonable weather. There was a fair swell running, but not much in the way of heavy winds. We proceeded down the Bay of Biscay, well out at sea, and before we got to the North Spanish coast, we cut away to the southwest, and we were heading in the very general direction of the Azores. This was the operational area that we had been designated to cover. And it was an easy journey. We had no alarms or excursions on the way down, and we had been doing all our onboard training on the way, exercising the depth charge crews, exercising the guns crews, constantly exercising the ASDIC operators, and making sure that all the new masthead lookouts and bridge lookouts were beginning to learn to do their job properly. So anyway, around about the 20th or thereabouts of February, in the middle watch, that is to say between midnight and 4 a.m., my HSD, Royce Benson, whose name I'd mentioned previously, was operating the ASDIC set. And as I told you before, he was training to become a physiotherapist when he left the Navy. And when he was operating the ASDIC set, he used to sit there looking at charts of the human body, an extraordinary occupation. Anyway, he was operating the set, and he suddenly called out to the bridge that he thought he could hear a strange noise coming through the headphones. And he asked permission to switch off ASDIC transmissions and be allowed to simply listen for hydrophone effect on the headphones. So the officer of the watch agreed and told him to switch off transmission, and Benson trained the oscillator right ahead and trained it probably 10 degrees either side of the bow. And when he was right in the dead center, straight ahead position, he said, "I can hear a high-speed diesel engine running." And the officer of the watch listened on the bridge loudspeaker and agreed that the sound that Benson had heard, over and above the normal ASDIC transmissions, certainly sounded like a high-speed diesel engine. Well, high-speed diesel engines in those waters generally meant submarines. So the captain was called. I was called, because I was not on watch at the time, and I, as ASCO, I dashed to the bridge. The captain came to the bridge. I listened to this sound as well, and I agreed that it certainly sounded like high-speed diesel. So I suggested to the captain that because of the very calm weather conditions, it might be a good idea if we tried what was known as a hand transmission with the ASDIC.
So just explain that again in the story.
Yes. Now, this means that you could send a sound wave out from the oscillator, not on the normal automatic sequencing of 2.5 seconds between transmissions, but by means of a Morse key. Literally, you could bang your finger down on the Morse key and send out a single sound wave. And then you could time this by means of a chronoscope, which in fact was a stopwatch calibrated in yards rather than in seconds, or was it calibrated in yards as well as in seconds. And this was designed to receive echoes at a much greater distance than the normal 2,500 yards with the automatic transmission. And sure enough, Benson did about 4 or 5 transmissions a few degrees either side of the bow and timed each one with the chronoscope. And suddenly he actually got an echo, and the chronoscope indicated that the distance was 8,000 yards. Now this was absolutely, well, almost unheard of. The weather conditions and the water conditions must have been absolutely ideal in order for this to have happened. And anyway, he got this echo at approximately 8,000 yards. By this time, we had called up the senior officer, Commander Gwinner, on Afflick, on the TBS, which perhaps I'd mentioned earlier. This was our high-frequency radio communication. TBS, it was an American... TBS was an American description of this system, which meant talk between ships. And it was a very effective shortwave communication system between ships in a group or in close company with each other.
And it was a high frequency.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact frequency, but it was pretty high frequency. Anyway, Commander Gwinner had been alerted by means of the TBS, and he'd come to the bridge of Afflick, and he gave us permission, since we had found this echo, and we had identified it, hopefully, as a submarine echo, he had given us permission to go ahead on our own and make the first attack. The group had been moving at about 12 knots up to this point. We then accelerated away, went up to about 18 knots for the first mile or so, and then reduced speed to 15 knots, which would be our normal speed for a depth charge attack. The echoes were now being picked up with greater frequency. Pardon me. And after a little while, the normal ASDIC transmissions were able to be resumed on the automatic scale, and the attack proceeded exactly as per the book.
Now, can you just describe it?
Yes. The HSD Benson was using the ASDIC machinery. He was operating the oscillator and recording the distance and the range of the target. The recorder alongside him, the recorder operator, was using his machine, which had a paper roll on it, rather like you get on a barograph. And this was showing clearly the exact range of the target. The information was being fed, that is to say, the information as to bearing and distance was being fed all the time to the automatic plot in the chart room, and a calculation was being made as to the course we should take in order to intercept and make a proper attack. Before we got to the attacking distance, the submarine had obviously heard us coming and had started to dive.
It was on the surface.
Oh, yes, it was on the surface. Diesel engines, remember?
That's right.
I'm sorry.
Sorry about that.
It's all right, okay. The submarine had now dived, and we set the pattern, the depth charge pattern, for a shallow submarine. I think, if my memory serves me correctly, this was known as pattern C for Charlie, which meant that each of the depth charges in the pattern had its depth setting set to a particular depth, and the whole plan was that the whole pattern of 10 charges would explode in sequence at approximately the correct depth, and hopefully the submarine would be receive severe damage in the process. Anyway, the attack was made in the normal way. The depth charges were dropped, and they duly exploded. We, by this time, had passed on to the extent of a few hundred yards, and Benson was now sweeping astern with his ASDIC equipment, and he picked up the echo a second time through the explosions. The ship proceeded on a little further, and we turned round, and then another of the ships in the group came in and did another attack.
Do you know which ship?
I can't remember which one it was. It was, I think, Garley's, but I really cannot be sure about that, so it's best not to make any factual statement about it. Anyway, after the second attack, all the ships were now in position close to the submarine, and we then suddenly saw it surfacing right in front of us. This was by now somewhere around about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Now what date was this? Because I think we've looked it up and it's not there.
It was the 25th of February 1944 when all this happened, early in the morning of the 25th of February.
She was surfacing
yes.
in front of you because you had turned and were returning.
That's right, we were returning, and the submarine, as a result of either the first or the second depth charge attack, we really don't know which, was now on the surface and listing over to one side. We immediately opened up with our 3-inch guns, A gun and B gun, and the submarine passed down our side, so that then the Oerlikons were able to open up on the conning tower. There was nobody visible at this time at all on the submarine. None of them had come up on deck, so there was no gun action from their point of view. We were throwing everything we could at the submarine as it passed down the side of the ship.
Now, do you know which submarine it was, just to...
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. You want the name now?
The number, if you know.
Yes. It turned out that the submarine was the U-91. And as she was passing down the ship's side, large numbers of men were seen coming out of the conning tower onto the casing of the submarine.
Now, before we go, I'll come to that, because I know that's a big part of the story. What about the effect of the 3-inch fire and the Oerlikon fire on the submarine? Did it have any noticeable impact?
To be absolutely honest, I couldn't tell you the answer to that. What we saw of the submarine was where our 24-inch searchlight lit it up. And where we saw it, we could see bullets bouncing off the conning. We could certainly see the 20mm shells hitting the conning tower and the casing. As for the 3-inch shells, I can't be 100% certain and say, yes, I saw them hit the submarine. I think I did, but I couldn't swear to it.
But no visible damage?
No particular visible damage, but a hail of fire was enveloping the thing.
And there is a picture of this that was taken by...
That's right, by our navigating officer. Now, do you want me to say that now? Yeah. Okay. So at this stage, we saw a number of men coming out of the conning tower onto the casing of the submarine, and the captain gave the order to cease fire. It was quite obvious that they were not going to do anything aggressive towards us. They were obviously frightened to death.
They weren't making a move towards...
No, the gun, no. So at this point, the submarine was listing fairly badly by now, and the members of the crew who were on the casing all jumped into the water. We realise now that the battle with this particular vessel was over, so the captain gave the order to rig ladders and scrambling nets. on the side nearest to the survivors, and the ship was brought to a stop. This was in agreement, this was by agreement from Commander Gwinner, who then mounted a sort of a protective circle round us to protect us from any possible attack from a sister submarine, bearing in mind that we were lit up like a Christmas tree at this stage. A considerable number of the German sailors swam towards us, and they either climbed up the ladders and scrambling nets or were hauled up by our own crew who were standing by for that purpose. After about, I suppose, 10 minutes or so of this, Commander Gwinner said, "Right, that's it, boys. You can't stay there any longer. Up sticks and away."
Now, this order's just slightly controversial because some of the crew of the Gore said that there were still Germans in the water.
Indeed. Oh, yes, that's right. There were. That's right. Commander Gwinner said, "We can't leave you there any longer, stopped dead in the water, lit up in this manner. You've had enough time to collect as many survivors as you can. It's now time to move on." So, acting under his orders, the ship pulled away, leaving a considerable number of Germans swimming about in the water.
How many, roughly?
Guesswork, 20 plus.
So more than you'd rescued?
Yes, oh yes.
How did people feel about that?
Well, they didn't like it very much, but on the other hand, they could see the common sense of it. You couldn't just sit around in the water out in the middle of the Atlantic in wartime when the place could be crawling with submarines and ready to take a submarine, a torpedo in the midships section somewhere. So it wasn't a nice thing to do. None of us liked doing it, but we realised that we had really no alternative. Or that Commander Gwinner had no alternative but to give the order that he did. So, unfortunately, we sailed away, leaving a considerable number of these blokes, possibly 30, I don't know exactly how many, still swimming about in the water, and they were dead meat. There are no two ways about that.
There were no Carly floats thrown over or anything?
No, nothing. Nothing at all.
And did you actually see the submarine sink?
We saw it tilt right over on its side, and that was the last we saw of it. I never actually saw it.
When had the photograph been taken?
The photograph had been taken when we were close to the submarine and still firing our Oerlikons at it. The 3-inch guns were no longer being fired because we were too close to it. The Oerlikons were being fired. And all this was being done in the light of the 24-inch searchlight mounted in front of the wheelhouse.
It's quite a dramatic photo.
Absolutely.
We're going to ask you to just copy that.
Sure. Well, it's your photograph. You've got it.
Oh, it's in the warm
place. Oh, absolutely, yes. That print came from I've got the little one, you saw that, but the big one is from the Imperial War Museum. You've got it.
So I'll put the number in the file.
Oh, absolutely, yes, sure.
So
we have this situation that the ship is now was stopped while this firing was going on, and after that while the survivors were being picked up. So our navigating officer, who was on the bridge, didn't have much navigating to do at that particular time, so he got his camera out and took a few shots of the submarine in the light of the searchlights. That's how he got that particular shot. Anyway, all the survivors were lined up on the upper deck, on the port side, on the upper deck, lying flat on their backs on the deck, gasping and spluttering and generally in a fairly nasty condition. Now, as I told you earlier on, one of our officers, Lieutenant Bill Mock, spoke German as a second language. He'd learnt German as a child from his grandparents and I think from his parents, and could speak fluent German. So he was sent down by the captain to ask each individual survivor for the number of his U-boat. With the explicit threat that if he didn't give the answer, he'd be back over the side again. This, of course, was not intended, but it was threatened. Fortunately, they all gave the same number, 91. So we knew that the submarine which had been destroyed was in fact the U-91. Now, these men consisted of 11 or 12 ratings and four officers. As it turned out, we had got the captain of the U-boat, we had got the doctor, they carried a doctor apparently, the engineer, and a young junior officer whom I will call a sub-lieutenant for lack of any better title. So we had the captain and three of his officers, and the other 11 or possibly 12 were ratings of one sort or another. Now, the trick was to find out what we had to do with these people. So it was a question of finding the confidential book that gave detailed instructions on what to do with prisoners of war. And we found out that we had to separate the captain from his officers, and we had to separate the officers from the ratings. This presented a certain sort of housekeeping problem on a rather small ship. But what was eventually done, the German captain, a man called Captain Leutnant Hungershausen, was given the captain's day cabin, which is the best accommodation on the ship. It's where he lived when the ship was in harbour. A very nice, spacious cabin with its own bathroom, etc., etc. Here, this is where the German captain was put. The other three officers, the doctor, the engineer, and the sub-lieutenant, were given a double cabin off the ward, which went off the wardroom, and which was normally occupied by Lieutenant Mock. They were given this double cabin with an extra mattress on the deck for the three of them to sleep on. And the ratings were given a corner of the after mess deck where they had their being while they were on board the ship. That was the sort of location of the people. Now, what happened after that was that each day they were all, each group, the captain on his own, the officers on their own, and the ratings on their own, were given an opportunity to exercise on the gun deck, and this they did for an hour or so in the daytime. The doctor, a man called Seebacher, he started carrying out a surgery on board the ship. We didn't carry a doctor. We carried a sickbay artificer, a chap called Gillam. And he had a very, very nice sickbay. This was, bearing in mind, this was an American ship. And it was a beautifully equipped sickbay. And the doctor used to have a little surgery every morning with Gillam in the sick bay, dealing with cuts and bruises and abrasions and anything else that cropped up with members of the crew. It was quite an interesting situation.
How did you get on with them? I mean, did you mix with them?
Yes. As I told you, the officers were located in a cabin immediately off the wardroom. And they used to have their meals with us in the wardroom at the table. And whereas two of them spoke no English, the doctor did. He spoke not a great deal, but enough for sort of normal conversations. And we got on reasonably well with them. We conversed with them about day-to-day things. The only time that politics ever entered into the conversation that I heard of was when the Germans suggested to us that it would be far better if we had been fighting with them against the Russians rather than with the Russians against them. They saw Russia as the biggest danger in the world, Bolshevism as they called it. They couldn't see that fascism was a problem. I'm still astonished to this day to think that intelligent men could still think like that. But nevertheless, that was how it came across from them. Other than that, they shared the wardroom with us. They were allowed to use the wardroom through the day. They slept in their cabin at night, and they got their bit of exercise on the deck each for a short time each day. This went on now for about another 4 days or thereabouts, four days I think it was, until one morning at about
round about the 29th.
Yes, that's right. Around about the 29th of February, one of the other ships in the group got an ASDIC contact. I can't remember which ship it was, but it happened at about 5:30 in the morning, 0530, on that day. An ASDIC contact was obtained, and this was agreed by all concerned after a little checking up that it was a German, that it was a submarine. And so a series of attacks were initiated by Commander Gwynne. Various ships did their attacks on this Echo, and including the Gore, and no results were obtained from any of these depth charge attacks that were carried out. Several hedgehog attacks were attempted, but again, no result was achieved. This went on for the whole of that morning and the afternoon of that day, and no results were achieved at all. The submarine appeared to be getting deeper and deeper. The reason we knew that this was happening was that when the ships were approaching the submarine with their ASDIC transmissions going, they were losing contact at greater and greater distances, which meant that the ASDIC beam was passing over the submarine rather than hitting it. And that meant that the submarine, and that the greater the distance that you lost contact, the greater the depth of the submarine.
It also manoeuvring?
Yes, the submarine was constantly manoeuvring, probably only doing a very slow speed, probably no more than 1.5 to 2 knots. This would be common sense from the point of view of conserving his electric power for his electric motors. The maximum speed submerged of these submarines was something like 7 or 8 knots. But if they did that speed, they probably would only have enough power to run for about an hour, if that. But at 1.5 or 2 knots, they had considerable ability to operate for a considerable length, much longer period of time. Anyway, the attacks went on. Contact kept being maintained by the ships, one after the other. And the attacks went on all through the first day and most of that next night. And no result was obtained, but the submarine was always there, still there.
There's a thing here that
Gwynne
was sort of using a tactic of trying to exhaust the submarine.
Oh, yes, that's right. Commander Gwynne came to the conclusion at one stage that probably the best thing to do would be to hunt it to exhaustion, that is to say, to maintain contact with it until it had no choice but to surface for lack of oxygen, for lack of air. That was his original plan.